Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Hillary Clinton now has 2.3 million more votes than Donald Trump. That's expected to rise to 2.5 million. The New York Times editorial board writes, as a percentage of the electorate, that is a wider margin than five presidents enjoyed. With support for third-party candidates added in, 54% of voters rejected Mr. Trump. But because Donald Trump won key battleground states like Pennsylvania, Florida, and Michigan, he has 306 electoral college votes to Hillary Clinton's 232. This has yet again raised questions about the legitimacy of the electoral college. Electoral college votes undermine a fundamental principle of democracy: one person, one vote. Broken down by states, the proportion of electoral college votes are also imbalanced. For example, one Wyoming vote is three times more powerful than one vote in California, according to the Equal Citizens Project. Well, in a recent Washington Post op-ed, today's guest, Lawrence Lessig, argues that the Electoral College should support the will of the majority of the voters and elect Hillary Clinton on December 19th. Lawrence Lessig is professor of law at Harvard Law School and founder of Root Strikers, an activist network opposed to corruption in government. Professor Lessig has authored a number of books, including Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It, and One Way Forward, The Outsider's Guide to Fixing the Republic. And Lawrence Lessig joins us on the line from Amsterdam. Hi, Professor Lessig. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. In your piece in the Washington Post, you do not argue for the elimination of the Electoral College, but for the Electoral College to honor the will expressed by the majority of voters. Lay out what you're calling for exactly.
Well, that's right. So historically, the Electoral College has always supported the majority voter, the majority candidate, except twice, 1888 and in 2000. And that principle of supporting what the people have said is consistent with how the framers saw the project that they were launching on by setting up this republic that would have, in effect, an elected president. As Madison said, it should be the as Hamilton said, it should be the sense of the people that determined who the president is. But nobody had done it before. So they set up this intermediate body of citizens, not politicians, who are supposed to review what the people have said and only veto it if they've got a pretty good reason. And for most of our history, they've not vetoed it. And my argument is that principle in favor of democracy has only grown stronger over the 230-plus years of our history. And that after the Supreme Court in 1962 said the principle of one person, one vote is fundamental to our democracy, I think the Electoral College electors should consider that principle. And if they did that, they would say there's no good reason for us to overturn the democratic will here of such an overwhelming support for Hillary Clinton, and they should vote to uphold that result rather than to veto it.
You write that conventional wisdom tells us that the Electoral College requires that the person who lost the popular vote this year must nonetheless become our president. That view is an insult to our framers. It's compelled by nothing in the Constitution. You write it should be rejected by anyone with any understanding of our democratic traditions. Most important, the electors themselves. Have you heard from any of these electors?
No, I think the electors are hiding because they're under such siege by so many different people for many different reasons to get them to switch their vote. But, you know, I think that the point that I'm trying to highlight by this editorial, by this op-ed, is that many people have this conception of the Electoral College that is that the framers said in the Constitution that the electors shall vote for the winner of that state, and then if a majority support a candidate, then that candidate is our president. But the Constitution doesn't say anything like that. All the Constitution says is that the president's going to be selected by electors. And indeed, the framers thought these electors should exercise their judgment. And in the 230 years since our founding, what the states have done is they've imposed on the electors restrictions on how they can vote. And the most dramatic restriction is the one-person, one-vote restriction. Is the winner-take-all restriction, which says, you know, if a state could have 49.9% supporting one candidate and 50.1% supporting the other candidate, and all the electoral votes have to go to the person who got just 0.1% greater than the runner-up. And that principle is the principle that's creating this great inequality across the states, as some states have radically more power in selecting our presidents and others. And my view is we're all citizens of the United States. And especially in California, the California voter is a fraction, a third or a quarter of the vote of the value of a vote for many other people around the country. And I think people in California ought to say, you know, hey, what the heck? You know, we're just as much citizens as anybody else. Why should we be so irrelevant to the count of who becomes our president? Because that's a president for us, too. And I think this view, reviving the sense of how important it is that we are all equally citizens in the United States, should compel electors to do the right thing and to vote consistent with that that ideal.
And, of course, we don't really pay attention to these details when our candidate wins, or in this case, Hillary Clinton getting the popular vote but not the Electoral College, and so this is now getting so much attention. On December 19th, the electors will officially gather to file their votes, and the election's not technically decided until they do that. Who are these electors, and how do they become electors?
Well, that's a dramatic fact. We don't know we don't know of the electors. We actually know the list, the names of the electors. But we don't know them because they're typically just selected by the party to be a reliable vote in case that party happens to win the election in the particular states. And that's because, for the most part, there's nothing really to think about when you're an elector, because both parties typically nominate highly qualified candidates, and in all but two cases, winner is a winner of both the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. So there's no complicated question here, and they just basically rubber stamp what the democracy has done. But the framers thought that, you know, that might be true 90% of the time or 99% of the time, but we need to have a mechanism, a kind of circuit breaker, if something goes wildly wrong. And I know there are many people out there in the movement to get the electors to switch their vote who say, this is that case because Donald Trump is not a qualified candidate for president. But my argument has nothing to do with whether you think Donald Trump is a qualified candidate for president or not. I certainly didn't support Donald Trump, but 62 million Americans did think he was a qualified candidate. So I get that. My argument is, whether you think he's a qualified candidate or not, whether you think 62 million Americans are wrong, 64 million Americans supported a different candidate, a candidate nobody could doubt is qualified. Indeed, I think the most qualified candidate in a generation for the presidency. And that principle of majority vote ought to guide how the electors think about their job here.
And over 90 million eligible voters did not vote in the presidential election. I'm wondering how many of them regret not voting.
Oh, of course, because, I mean, you experienced this as much as I did. Going into this election, everybody thought it was completely sewed up. So why should you show up? You know, and of course, this is a classic mistake, that one assumes that the polls are going to tell us anything that we need to know. But I'm sure, has led many people to have deep regrets. You said something earlier, I just want to make sure we flag this. You said, you know, we raise this problem only when our candidate loses. Donald Trump is on the record very strongly opposed to the Electoral College. Mm-hmm. In 2012, there was a period of time where it looked like Barack Obama would win the Electoral College but lose the popular vote. And Donald Trump went on a tweet storm where he said, quote, the Electoral College is a disaster for a democracy. He said, let's fight like hell and stop this great and disgusting injustice. The world is laughing at us. quote, he lost the popular vote by a lot and won the election. We should have a revolution in that in this country. So in 2012, when Donald Trump imagined the very same thing happening as happened this year, he said it was outrageous and we ought to have a revolution about it. Well, I'm not sure we should have a revolution. I just think that 37 electors ought to look at the reality and say there's no good reason for us to turn down the person who won the majority vote on November 8th.
And Professor Lessig, imagine if the electors took your advice, imagine what Donald Trump's tweets would look like. I want to quote constitutional lawyer Garrett Epps, who wrote in The Atlantic about an electoral college switch. He says, quote, Clinton's popular vote victory is nearly unprecedented in its sheer size. The American people rejected Trump by a wide margin. As a minority president claiming a mandate for dictatorial powers, he is a mortal danger to American democracy. But a Clinton presidency obtained by such a switch would, in a different way, also risk destroying the system. Trump voters would be as outraged by that maneuver as Clinton voters if the tables were turned. End quote. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I agree. This is the part of this whole argument that gives me most pause. Mm-hmm. It's the recognition that we are so partisan that we can't see principle beyond our partisan commitments. So, you know, my view is there's a principle we all share here in common that, you know, in a democracy, the person who wins ought to win. But it's striking to me, it's terrifying to me, how impossibly difficult it is for people to see that when it goes against their own particular political party. And I think, you know, in a really important way, America, the American constitutional democracy, is under severe strain right now because of the number of contexts in which the majority does not win. So in the Senate, plainly more people voted for Democratic candidates in the Senate than Republican candidates, but Republicans control the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
If 2016 is like 2014, we don't have the final numbers yet, more people will have voted Democratic for people in the House of Representatives, but the Republicans will control the House of Representatives. And here with the presidency, if the Electoral College does what people think it is likely to do, then there will, more people will have voted Democratic in the presidency, but the Republicans will control the presidency too. So the Republicans will control these three parts of our federal government and therefore also be able to control the courts, even though they are the minority in each of these three contexts. Now, in those three areas, only the Senate is compelled by the Constitution to give this power to the minority party. It's, you know, it's just in the architecture of the Senate that the states, especially in the middle part of the country, are going to have more influence, and that's just the way it is. You can't change that unless you change the Constitution. But the House of Representatives is not representative because of the gerrymandering politicians engage in, and the presidency is not reflective of the popular vote because of the states in position of this winner-take-all rule. So these are corruptions to the systems of democratic selection, which are producing this minority government and this loophole presidency. And I think it's a significant danger in a democracy if you allow these anti-democratic results to continue and to perpetrate.
Wow, you call it a minority government, and he made me think about an interview we had with David Daley about his book, Rat Effed, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. And he writes extensively about gerrymandering, about this red map program that has radically altered the electoral map and created a firewall in the House. We have so many conversations about this. Unfortunately, this issue doesn't get much attention in the national media. What can people do about this, people who do not want to live in a minority government, in a minority system?
Well, I think Dave Daley's book is really fantastic. It's a little bit embarrassing title, so you can't talk about it very easily with people. But it's a great book because what it does is demonstrate that the inequality, the unrepresentativeness that we see is not just an accident or not just a byproduct of, you know, how we happen to be living. It is constructed. It is an intentional political strategy that produces this unequal representation. And, you know, when I step back and I look at all the different problems in our democracy, they all come down to the basic lack of representativeness in our system. You know, I've just described how each of these three branches is not representing the majority. But even, you know, for the Democratic Party, when you think about the amount of time representatives spend raising money from the tiniest fraction of the 1%, even they can't very well represent the average American because they're spending so much time begging from the richest of Americans. So the point is, we've built into our politics inequality all the way down. And I think what we need to do to fight back against that is to begin to recognize the fundamental commitment of a representative democracy is to the equality of their citizens. And we have allowed that commitment to be corrupted in so many ways that we've got to find a way to fight back to get it back. Now, typically people talk about this issue in very different silos. They talk about campaign finance, they talk about gerrymandering, they talk about suppression of the vote, they talk about the problem of the Electoral College. But what I think we need to do is to recognize these are all the same problem. These are the problem of a constitutional democracy that has given up the core principle that we are all equal citizens. And we ought to fight for that principle, because if we don't, then in all these different dimensions, we're not going to have anything like a representative government.
What do you think is the most effective way to fight, especially given most of our listeners are in California and their representatives are Democrats?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to begin to raise the level of frustration and anger directed at this systematic inequality, and actually to begin to build bridges, not in the context of this presidential race, because it's obvious we're so partisan in this presidential race, nothing good is going to come of it, but after this presidential race, to begin to build bridges with Republicans who also look at our government and feel like the government is not responsive to the people. I mean, I think the most powerfully effective strategy Trump deployed in the last weeks of the campaign was this constant refrain on draining the swamp. And I think the biggest mistake Hillary Clinton's campaign made was not to take him on directly on that, because I think they thought they could just duck the issue and get away with it. But I think that the overwhelming passion that he could tap into and this idea of getting rid of the corruption inside of Washington is a manifestation of this deep sense we have, many Americans have, that our system doesn't represent us. And we need to find a way to build bridges to people whose substantive values are very different from ours, to begin to talk about how we're going to get back the idea of a democracy that's actually representative. And that's in our partisan time, that's an incredibly difficult struggle to imagine succeeding in. But unfortunately, I think it's the struggle we have to engage and win.
Lawrence Lessig is professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School and founder of Root Strikers, an activist network opposed to corruption in government. He's the author of many books, including Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Lawrence Lessig has an op-ed in the Washington Post arguing that the Electoral College should support the will of the majority of voters and elect Hillary Clinton on December 19th. That is when the electors get together and officially file their votes. So what are your thoughts on Lawrence Lessig's argument? What questions do you have about the Electoral College? What do you think about the Electoral College? And then we're also going to talk about recount efforts. Jill Stein has raised over $6 million for the recount, which is more than she raised for her Green Party presidential campaign. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, tweet us at yourcallradio, or leave a comment on our website. Ruby in Mill Valley couldn't stay on, but she says, "I'm mystified by who the electors are and if they can actually be lobbied."
Well, there's a site which has been set up by people who are trying to lobby the electors. It's called MakeDemocracyMatter.org, one word, MakeDemocracyMatter.org. And what they've done is they've highlighted the electors in each state that in 28 Trump states, they've highlighted the electors at least. And if you click on the state, they give you the list of the electors, and if you click on a particular elector, you can see the link to an email or telephone or Twitter name or Facebook page, if that information was available to people to put together the site. The site's pretty incredible in the amount of data that they've gathered. And it might be too successful because many of the electors, I understand, have just turned off their computer and shut down and gone on vacation because they never signed up for this amount of pressure.
And what about conflicts of interest? Salon had an article about this by Gary Legum, and he writes that Pam Bondi, Florida's attorney general, is an elector and a member of Trump's transition team. Her history with Trump came under scrutiny during the campaign when it was revealed that she solicited a $25,000 campaign donation from Trump in 2013, which he illegally paid out of funds from his charitable foundation. And then 4 days after Trump cut that check, Pam Bondi announced her office would not pursue fraud charges against Trump over his university scam.
Yeah, so I think the Bondi issue is a very serious issue, independent of the electors. I mean, the fact that she's an elector just is just icing on the cake. But I think that if you looked at electors on both the Republican and Democratic side, going back over the last 100 years, you'd find that many of them have very deep connections into the parties and lots of connections that one might think of as a conflict. But the reality is it didn't really matter much. Because there wasn't much for them to do. There wasn't a reason for them to throw somebody out because he or she was not qualified. And there was very infrequently, only twice, did they actually confront a case where the person who won in the popular vote was not the person who won in the Electoral College. And those two times, I think they made a mistake. But for the rest of the times, it was a pretty easy vote. Just do what they people say, and we get the answer that's consistent with the popular vote.
Again, this website is makedemocracymatter.org, and wow, great website, nicely done. You click on the state, and there is a list of all of the electors' name, photo, contact information. And as Lawrence said, most of these people have probably turned off their phones because I bet they're being slammed. Let's take a caller before break. Let's go to Jim in Oakland. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I had a question. It's probably similar to the last question, but really how probable it is that the electors could change their vote. And also a little bit more about, maybe you said this earlier, was it built into the Constitution that they would be a check and balance and that that exactly what's happened would be the reason that they might, you know, decide to change their vote?
All right. Thank you. Lawrence, were you able to hear Jim's question?
Yes. Let's take the second question first. They certainly were put into the Constitution to be a kind of check on the process. You know, many people talked about the idea of having direct election of the president, and nobody had done that before. And so they didn't really know how they would make something like that work. So they let the selection be done in the states with the presumption the states would allow the electors to be chosen by the voters, and some states did originally, and eventually every state did. But they imagined the electors would be able to exercise, as Hamilton said, independent judgment. And that judgment is supposed to weigh what are the qualifications necessary and whether the person that's been selected meets those qualifications. In 9 of the last 17 elections, there have been electors who have voted against what the rules of the state said that they should the person they should vote for. Now, it hasn't mattered, and only one time did you see somebody vote across the party line, but they've exercised that power. And I think most scholars believe that they were intended to have the independent authority to make a judgment that was different from the rules that were imposed on them by the state, and that could happen in this case. I think nobody at this point thinks it's likely, but the point is there's so much is happening so quickly, and there's so much anxiety about the tensions that has developed, and lots of questions about the substance of Donald Trump as a president, again, an issue I'm not pushing, that my view is anything can happen right now, and it's going to be a really interesting 2 weeks to see how it develops.
If the tables were turned and Donald Trump got more popular votes than Hillary Clinton, but she got more Electoral College votes, would you still be calling for this?
You know, I hope I would. Before 2000, I was at a conference in Washington where I made the claim that there would be a revolution if it went, if the Electoral College went against the popular vote. And that was at a time when the hypothetical that we're talking about was exactly that, that the Democrat won, as Trump thought in 2012 was going to be true of President Obama. The Democrat won the Electoral College and didn't win the popular vote. So I hope I would be. And we should all hold ourselves to standards to try to be consistent. But what we've now seen is it's twice gone against the Democratic candidate in the last 16 years. And if this begins to be a regular pattern, I again fear how this weakens our belief and commitment to the idea of a majority democracy.
Lawrence Lessig is professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. In a recent op-ed in the Washington Post, he argues that the Electoral College should support the will of the majority of voters and elect Hillary Clinton on December 19th. That is when the electors officially get together to file their votes. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org. You may tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our coverage of Standing Rock by talking about what rights water protectors have to remain where they are. The North Dakota governor has issued an evacuation order. The Army Corps of Engineers plans to close off access to the main camp by December 5th. 2,000 veterans are on their way to Standing Rock to act as human shields between police and water protectors. I was just reading last night that so many veterans want to go, they're actually being turned away, and they're also being asked to show up in uniform. So this is going to be so interesting to watch. We'll talk about the legal basis of the governor and the Army Corps' orders and who has standing to challenge these actions. That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the Electoral College. Hillary Clinton's vote is expected to rise to about 2.5 million. Right now she's got about 2.3 million more popular votes than Donald Trump. But because Trump won key battleground states like Pennsylvania, Florida, and Michigan, he has 306 Electoral College votes to Clinton's 232. And so many people are talking about this for obvious reasons. Jill Stein has raised over $6 million for a recount. That's more money than she raised for her Green Party presidential campaign. Lawrence Lessig has an op-ed in the Washington Post arguing that the Electoral College should support the will of the majority of voters and elect Hillary Clinton. Lawrence Lessig is professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. And now I would like to welcome Lawrence Norden to the show, deputy director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Hi, Lawrence Norden. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Before we talk about recount efforts, I just want to get your take on Lawrence Lessig's argument that the Electoral College should support the will of the majority of voters and elect Hillary Clinton on December 19th when they all get together officially.
Well, you know, Professor Lessig has thought about this a lot more than I have, but, you know, I think the, of course, the challenge with that argument is that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump understood the rules to be that the candidate with the most electoral votes wins, and that's how they campaigned. So There's certainly an argument that it would be changing the rules after the fact, and that they hadn't campaigned under, with the assumption that the candidate with the most votes would be the one who would win, as opposed to the most electoral votes.
And talking about the recount, Jill Stein has raised more than $6.5 million. The goal is to raise $9.5 million in total. Wisconsin officials announced that they received the required $3.5 million to begin the recount. First off, why is so much money needed to begin these recounts?
Well, it costs money to run elections. I think we forget that, and there's a lot of manpower involved, and hiring people to recount the votes, and you have to have members of both political parties present to ensure that the count is fair, and it takes a lot of time, and these people aren't just available. It is not their full-time job, so you have to recruit and hire people to be involved in the recount. So it's just expensive.
So Donald Trump won Wisconsin by 22,525 votes, Pennsylvania 68,030, and Michigan 10,704. This is according to the Cook Political Report. Since Wisconsin officials have received the $3.5 million to begin the recount, how does this work exactly? And how much time are we talking?
Well, that's a good question. One of the issues is that the reason that Jill Stein and many who supported her gave for the recount is that these machines are not secure, and that there have been reports of foreign governments, Russia in particular, attempts to hack various election-related websites and the DNC email server and voter registration databases. I should say voting machines are not connected to the internet, so it's a far greater challenge to hack into these systems. But there are people who have shown that they're not as secure as they should be. You would think that would mean that when they did a recount, it would be done by hand as opposed to just rerunning the ballots through the machines. But in fact, the Elections Commission in Wisconsin and a court stated that the counties get to choose, the towns that are doing the recounts get to choose whether or not they're done through a machine or there are hand recounts. So it's going to vary from town to town how the ballots are recounted.
And Lawrence Lessig, what are your thoughts on this recount effort?
Well, I think that the likelihood, just based on the numbers, of anything changing is quite small. But the important thing is, if they determine that there was intentional hacking, especially intentional hacking by a foreign government, I think that changes the game dramatically. And again, I think that invokes one of the key reasons why the electors were put into our constitutional system originally. You know, if you're an elector and you come to the view that the results in your state were produced by foreign governments hacking your election system, I think you have an obligation, a moral and legal obligation, to take that into account in deciding how you're in fact going to vote. And one thing so striking about this is just how underplayed this whole aspect of the story is. Now, maybe that's a good thing, because maybe we should wait until we have very solid evidence. We do have solid evidence of the Russian involvement in the election, at least in social media and other contexts like that. But if this were in fact to be proven in the actual way in which the votes were collected or tallied, then I think that's going to raise pressure on the electors much more significantly.
Lawrence Norden, a lot of people do not trust the system, period. I mean, we're hearing from a lot of listeners who don't trust the system. And J. Alex Halderman, professor of computer science with the University of Michigan, wrote an op-ed in Medium who says, quote, "How might a foreign government hack America's voting machines to change the outcome of a presidential election? Could anyone be brazen enough to try such an attack? A few years ago, I might have said that sounds like science fiction, but 2016 has seen unprecedented cyber attacks aimed at interfering with the election." And then go back to 2004, and we had on a lawyer in Ohio who said he found major discrepancies between John Kerry and George W. Bush, and he pointed to electronic voting machines.
Yeah, look, I mean, there's the good news in all of this is, to the extent that we take advantage of it, is a state like Wisconsin has paper records of all the votes that the voters have either filled out themselves, or there was a trail that they had an opportunity, a paper trail on the voting machine that they had an opportunity to review before they cast their ballots. So we can use that paper. That's the reason that it's there, to double check the electronic totals. And that's why the recount was asked for. So if the recount is done properly, it should give people extra assurance that we got the right outcome in a state like Wisconsin. There are other states like Pennsylvania that have paperless systems where there really is no way to do a good independent recount. And I would say, while it's not going to help for this election, I think it's really important to replace those old machines and make sure that we do have voter verified paper records, so that we can make sure that people do trust the results of the election. Having said that, one point I want to emphasize is that the Clinton campaign itself and others who have looked at it have said that in terms of just looking at what the totals are and what came out, there isn't a specific reason for suspicion of the totals.
And Lawrence Lessig, what do you say to people who don't trust the system?
I understand why they don't trust the system, and I think the system's got to think about what it needs to do differently to convince people. And part of the problem with the American electoral system generally is that we allow it to become so partisan. We allow the actual way in which the votes are collected and the system managed to be controlled by political people who behave in a political way. Now, that's not universally true. Like in Iowa, it's really quite striking in Iowa the way Democrats and Republicans work together to produce what seems like, to people in Iowa, a fair system. But that perception is not universal across the United States. And I think that we need to think about how do we behave in a way that is not just fair, but also seems fair. Because unless you convince people there's a reason to trust government, then the lack of trust in government is going to be really destructive of much of what government needs to accomplish.
And Lawrence Norton, I know we have to let you go soon. What changes would you like to see specifically to the voting system to ensure that people actually trust it again?
Well, a few things. First of all, as I said, I'd like to see we're facing a crisis when it comes to voting technology. The machines, most of the machines that are in use in the country are approaching the end of their lifespan, and that means that we have more breakdowns and long lines. I'd like to see those systems replaced, and as I mentioned before, in particular, systems that don't have voter-verified paper records so we can double-check the electronic records. I think we just have to invest more in upgrading our equipment to make sure that it's secure. And our voter registration system. We just need to modernize elections. They're not something that we invest in, and the cracks really show when you have a close, divisive contest like we just had.
It just seems like a paper trail is so obvious. The Electronic Frontier Foundation says if a paper trail isn't there and is never audited, it's useless to even recount. So why can't we just have paper trails across the country?
I think we should, and a lot of the country has moved in that direction. But we have relics of systems that were purchased immediately after the 2000 election, systems that were purchased even earlier than that, where some folks didn't want paper records for their machines. Some folks found recounts messy and divisive in them of themselves. But I think, particularly because of the advocacy of computer scientists and others, we understand that it's really important to have that record to be sure that the totals that we're getting are accurate.
Lawrence Norton is Deputy Director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Lawrence Norton, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we today are talking about the Electoral College, the recount, and if you have any questions or comments for Lawrence Lessig, who is Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. In a recent op-ed, Lawrence Lessig argues that the Electoral College should support the will of the majority of voters and elect Hillary Clinton when they meet officially on December 19th. And let's go to EJ in San Francisco. Hi, EJ. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to ask the professor, are you guys aware of the popular vote people? They've gotten 11 states and the District of Columbia to sign a compact where the electors in their states would vote for the general popular vote as opposed to the popular vote in the state. But what they're waiting for is they have to get another grouping of states to equal another 105 electors, so they have a total grouping of states that equal 270 electors. California signed on in 2010. New York has signed on. I'm wondering if this is at all possible to do, if they would be legally correct in this.
Yes, so the National Popular Vote Project is a fantastic innovation that takes advantage of something our Constitution has, which is something called compacts, which states can enter into, where the states basically have a contract with each other, and as long as Congress is okay with it, that contract is enforceable. So what they've done is found a way around the Electoral College structure without amending the Constitution, and I support that project, and I think that this election will certainly give a lot of energy to people who are finding a way to solve the problem of the Electoral College right now.
Well, thank you for that question. We have another one from Bernie in Noe Valley who says, though imperfect, the Electoral College prevents the interest of smaller states being overlooked in favor of those in larger states. Throwing it out for a simple popular vote will only increase the divisions across the country, divisions that were too apparent during the last election. It would give credence that our country is being led or misled by coastal elites and that Middle America has no voice. Similar sentiment is represented here in California by the Free State of Jefferson movement. This is getting a lot of attention too, this angle. Lawrence, what do you think about it?
So I understand the argument, and it is, I think, the most common argument made in defense of the Electoral College. It just doesn't have any connection to the reality of how presidential campaigns are actually conducted. There are 10 states, maybe 11, where presidential candidates compete. They are Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, Nevada, North Carolina, South Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, New Hampshire, Florida, maybe, and Colorado. Those are the states in which there's a campaign. And what the Electoral College is doing is basically elevating the significance of those states relative to everybody else. So New York is not on that list. Utah's not on the list. California is not on that list. Wyoming is not on that list. Big states and small states are not on that list because they don't happen to fit the profile of the competitive swing state dynamic of national presidential elections. Now, if we had a different system, basically a proportional system across the country, then what you'd see is presidential candidates trying to get votes in every state or as in many states as they can. And many more small states would have more attention paid to them by the presidential candidates than do now. So it's the kind of story you were told in high school about why they created the Electoral College, but it's just not true. The Electoral College was created for one reason. It's evolved into this system, which most of the time works perfectly fine, but when it goes off the rails, I think we need to have enough common sense to correct the mistake and to affirm the result that that is the overwhelming result of the democratic process.
Thank you for the email. We have a related question from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Yeah, from what I can tell, the number of Electoral College votes does not even get close to adequately representing the people, because if California has 55 electoral votes, that means that for every elector, that's more like 375,000 votes. Meanwhile, in states like Wyoming, one electoral vote is worth less than 100,000 people. So in reality, the smaller states do have actually more representation. And let's not forget that I believe it was Dennis Haskert back in the 2000s who did some very serious and probably illegal gerrymandering of states throughout, which gave too much representation to Republican-controlled districts and has made it more and more difficult for Democrats, or in my case, third parties such as the Green Party, to even get a headway.
Right. And Lisa, we touched on that earlier in the show, and we've done a lot of shows about that. But we're going to get a comment from Lawrence after a few more phone calls because people have been waiting patiently. Thank you for calling. Let's go next to Damon in Millbrae. Hi, Damon.
Yeah, hi there. My question is with regard to, I didn't quite understand Professor Lessing's point about how the House of Representatives, that more Democrats voted for Democrats, yet the House is controlled by Republicans. Is that just to do with gerrymandering, or is it that the population in the smaller states actually voted Democratic, but their votes were somehow weren't counted? I don't quite understand his point.
All right.
Thank you.
Lawrence, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, it's directly because of gerrymandering. Right. And again, the book, Dave Daley's book, is a fantastic account of that, and this is related to the earlier question, because Dennis Hastert began the project, but modern computer technology has perfected the ability of the people who draw the lines to draw them in a way that guarantee that they retain power, even though they might not happen to be the majority of votes in any election.
And Damon, I highly recommend listening to our show with David Daley. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. If you need some holiday reading, it's called Rat Effed. Thank you for calling. Let's go next to Scott in San Francisco. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Along the lines of what you were saying about one vote in California being worth about a third in Wyoming, I mean, it's just the fact that we voters in California are disenfranchised long before the general election, because in the primaries, by the time the primary gets to California, the candidate's already been decided. I mean, one year I voted early by mail for a candidate that dropped out by the time the vote actually got here. So, you know, how is that fair?
Mm.
But my question is that given the fact that California is nonetheless a powerful state, how can we in California use that power to change the system? I know Barbara Boxer introduced a bill in the Senate, but what chance does that have, and what can we do to support it?
Thank you. Lawrence?
Yeah, I'm always surprised by the willingness of California to get battered around by the rest of the country and marginalized by the rest of the country because, you know, after all, I mean, California is the Germany of the American, union, right? California is an incredibly wealthy, valuable state to the Union, and subsidizes a huge amount of American taxpayer dollars. Yet, both in the ordering of the primaries and in the way that votes are allocated in the Electoral College, you get short shrift. And, you know, you got to stand up and fight for it. You got to stand up and start insisting that, you know, you are just as much a citizen of the United States as anybody else, and you ought to have equal political power relative to other people. Now, I think there's a way of making that point that doesn't sound self-serving. You know, I think there's the evidence of historically being beaten up on from political power is pretty good, but I think the principle that you ought to be arguing for is that we all ought to have equal power. We all ought to be equal citizens here. It's not acres that Congress is supposed to represent. It's voters that Congress is supposed to represent. And so we need to build the recognition of how unfair we've allowed the system to become.
Mm.
And to push back against people, you know, when I've got hundreds of these angry emails from Trump supporters after my op-ed, the standard line they would make is, geez, if we didn't have the Electoral College, then California and New York would decide the election. And I would respond by saying, well, why don't they count? Why aren't they relevant to who gets to be president? Why isn't a California voter just as good as a voter from Wyoming or a voter from New Hampshire or a voter from Pennsylvania? Because our system doesn't equate them, and that it is supposed to, because that's what a democracy is supposed to do.
I was going to ask you why you think more Democrats don't talk about these issues, don't spend more time talking about these issues. And Laura has an email, just sent an email. Both parties are in the same swamp. She says, isn't the reason that the Dems will not battle the Electoral College is because the larger system is in fact working for the individuals who are in the White House and Congress? Why challenge minority rule if the Dems trust that their actual interests, Big Pharma, Wall Street, will be served very well and create the kind of tax structure and lax regulation system that the establishment Dems are on board with? The problem is the unstated deep power structure in which the Republicans and Democrats are on the same economic team versus the intentions of constitutional democracy.
Well, we don't have to make it unstated. We should state it directly. It is completely true, I believe, that when you have a system of privately funding political campaigns, and those funders are the tiniest fraction of the 1%, both political parties bend to make those funders happy. And that's the reality of American politics on the left and on the right. There are exceptions. Obviously, Donald Trump didn't get elected with, at least at the beginning of his campaign, he didn't care much about other people's money. And Bernie Sanders ran an amazing presidential campaign on small-dollar contributions. So at least going into it, you don't have to say those people were necessarily controlled by the money. But the point is, it's Congress that passes laws, and it's Congress that sets the parameters for what the president can even hope to achieve in his or her administration. And Congress is overwhelmingly driven by the desire to keep those funders happy. And until we change that, my view is nothing else is going to change. Now, the Democrats, I think, are complicit in not making this a primary focus of their campaigns, and I was extremely frustrated with Hillary Clinton that she didn't take this issue on, because I thought there was a real opportunity to rally a very frustrated America to the idea of real fundamental reform, and she actually had a plan that would achieve real reform, as opposed to Donald Trump, who talked about draining the swamp all the time, but literally has not yet articulated once any changes that would affect the corruption of Washington. So I'm deeply frustrated with the Democrats about this. But I think the real reason they don't take on the Electoral College is not so much that that's about the power structure. It's just, it's a constitutional amendment to fix it, finally. And I just think it seems so impossible to them that they don't even want to begin to get close to it.
And just quickly, Lawrence, why is that? According to reports, Barack Obama told Hillary Clinton to concede on election night, and Politico has a story called Clinton Team Shrugs Off Recount Effort. Jill Stein's recounts have energized hopeful Dems, but not Hillary Clinton's closest allies.
I think that they're looking at it very practically, and I think that they felt constrained by really what it seems now a brilliant move by Donald Trump to raise the question of the election being rigged. When he raised that question and Hillary Clinton was outraged at the idea anybody would question the American electoral system, that makes it very hard for you then to immediately question the American electoral system. And also, you know, the recounts in those three states, they seem like small numbers, but they don't. We don't typically see shifts that are large enough to undo the numbers like that. Mm. And what the campaign determined from the evidence they had was that there was statistically no reason to believe that there was real hacking going on. Now, again, we could look at it and see that there was evidence. When you see in the Wisconsin records, if there is real evidence of a gap between the paper records and what was reported, then all of that might change. But I just think they didn't see a shot, and unlike Hamilton, they were willing to give up their shot.
Lawrence Lessig is professor of law at Harvard Law School. Check out his op-ed at yourcallradio.org. Lawrence Lessig, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.